KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of December 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week, what the COVID-19 situation could be like this winter.
We are in a different phase right now that is very, very concerning.
A pair of acrimonious city council runoff elections with incumbents facing challengers who oppose cuts to the police budget.
We need to refund the police department.
And the lab mice we sacrifice in the development of a coronavirus vaccine.
They're small, they breed quickly, they're relatively inexpensive. I mean, they're not a perfect match for us, but they're better than, you know, say a salamander.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
The thrust of the most important messages trying to get out to the community right now is that our numbers are increasing, and everybody has to be aware of that, and then we need to, you know, stay home if you can. Do everything you can to try to keep the numbers down.
That's Austin Mayor Steve Adler speaking in early November, urging people to stay home to help keep COVID-19 numbers down as they were growing. And he recorded that message from his timeshare in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, where he was celebrating with his family. His daughter had just gotten married in Austin with the ceremony of about 20 people. The Austin American Statesman broke the story earlier in the week. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey spoke to the mayor about it shortly after the story broke. Here's part of that conversation.
Hey, Audrey.
Hi, Mayor. How are you?
Good.
We were under stage 3 restrictions when Mayor Adler's daughter had her wedding. Adler told Audrey they were following all local protocols.
Well, you know, we were in a restaurant situation. It was all outside. You go to restaurants in this city and there are events in this city where there are more than 10 people present, but you try to keep the groups of people to no more than 10. And we were in that kind of setting the entire time.
Okay. What do you
mean? I have a statement that I could give to you too.
Okay, that's fine. I'm just trying to understand the difference between when you say we were in that kind of setting. I don't quite.
We were outside the entire time.
Okay.
We were at a restaurant for the reception. We worked really hard to do a wedding and a trip that were consistent with the rules what I have been asking the community to do, because there are no exceptions for me and my family. And I know I'm proud of my daughter for canceling her wedding and going to a more COVID-friendly wedding than is even required by the rules.
When was the wedding that was canceled?
It was the same day.
Oh, okay.
But it was originally going to have, you know, more than 100 people. So she disinvited people to get the wedding to be small.
And so why not just wait till after? Why not just postpone
her wedding?
Yeah.
Because she wanted to be married.
And then later, Audrey asked the mayor about his trip on a private jet to Cabo and the appeal he made on Facebook for people to stay at home.
We need to stay home if you can.
Right, which is something that I have said every day since March. because the safest place for people to be is at home. And that's true. Stay at home when you can. It's the safest place to be. But I have not suggested that people just stay home, except during critical times. So that message that I gave that day was no different than the message that I give every day. It is, home is the safest place for people to be. But we have not asked people not to venture out of their homes, except for the period of time in March and April and when we did it in June.
Do you agree with the idea that public officials who are like yourself, who are saying we need to stay home if you can, should be modeling the safest, even if, yes, there's...
I don't think that government officials shouldn't leave their house. And I think that we see government officials all over the country who are leaving their houses, including the president-elect, who's been on stage with new cabinet appointees. I have been out of my home when we opened the new station downtown for Cap Metro. No, I don't think that, correct, at the police, yeah, at the cadet graduation. No, I do not think that government officials should be sequestered in their homes. That does not change the fact that the safest place for people to be is in their home. That remains true. But what we're asking people to do is to generally limit the physical interactions they have to the degree that they can. And when they venture out of their homes, to do it as safely as possible and consistent with the rules and guidelines. I expect government officials to model the behaviors that they're encouraging their communities to do. And I feel like I have done that. I have done that and continue to do that.
You don't believe that you or your family or the guests who came to the wedding did anything wrong?
Correct. Not only did we not do anything wrong, we didn't do anything that abrogated or violated the rules and regulations in the city or the conduct that we were expecting of others, that we also expect of ourselves. We are not in a place in this city where people are expected to sequester themselves in their homes. That's not the rules we have. Except during the period of time in March and in June when we were trying to arrest numbers that were putting us in a dangerous place. But we are asking people to be safe and to abide by certain recommendations which I have done.
Not long after this conversation, Mayor Adler put out an apology for his decision to travel to Mexico during the pandemic, and he explained it in yet another Facebook video.
I want you to know that I regret that travel. I wouldn't travel now. I didn't over Thanksgiving, and I won't over Christmas, and no one should. Everyone should be avoiding non-essential travel now because we're in the orange area. Now, I fear that the travel that I did, which took place during a safer period, followed the color-coded rules, could lead to some taking riskier behavior now. I recognize that my travel set a bad example. I recognize that the fact that I took that trip and at the same time was continuing to urge people to be cautious is confusing. I know that others have chosen not to travel under the same circumstances. And I know that in my position, I need to send a clearer message. I'm sorry I took that trip. It was a lapse in judgment, and I want you to know that I apologize.
Public health experts had warned the holiday season would be a dangerous time. Colder weather is forcing people inside. You have holiday gatherings. So it was expected that COVID-19 cases would spike in Texas. Now that we are well into the holiday season, KUT's Ashley Lopez reports on what the winter could bring.
Aliza Norwood is a physician and an assistant professor at Dell Medical School at UT Austin. Even though we've been dealing with the coronavirus since March, Norwood says where we are at the start of December just isn't the same.
We are in a different phase right now that is very, very concerning.
Norwood says the medical community in Texas has been ringing alarm bells for weeks. And now with COVID-19 cases on the rise, she says the situation is even more dangerous.
There's evidence of more community spread. So whenever you are gathering with people, because there's more community spread, there is a higher risk that somebody in that cohort that you're gathering with may be exposed to COVID or have COVID and not know it.
And if behaviors don't change, Norwood says there's going to be a strain on hospitals. Medical staff will have to focus more of their attention on treating COVID patients while other illnesses get less attention. And as more people get sick from COVID, she says, there will also be more deaths.
As a primary care physician who is caring for people who have had loved ones die or who themselves have been sick in the hospital, it's just completely devastating to individuals, to families, to the community. So seeing that, you know, up close and personal, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
This is why policy experts hope individual behavior will change. But they also want the behavior of state and local officials to change. Luis Figueroa with a policy think tank called Every Texan says he wants to see the state working more collaboratively with local officials in the state's big cities and counties.
There is no question that cities and counties, particularly urban cities, were on the front lines of trying to determine how to contain this, this global pandemic and continue from spreading. You know, from the get-go, it would have been ideal for there to be a clear understanding of what role cities and counties could play and what role the state would play.
Figueroa says the lack of clarity has made it harder for local officials to respond to outbreaks. For example, when to further restrict indoor gatherings, what to do about schools, and when to consider fully locking things down.
So we're believers in letting cities and counties set their priorities for things like that based on data-driven policy.
But state officials haven't seen it that way. Governor Greg Abbott has said flat out there won't be another statewide shutdown. And even when cities like El Paso have tried to shut down during a disturbing surge in cases, they have been met with a lot of resistance. Abbott has said that's because he doesn't think shutdowns work.
There's an overestimation of exactly what a shutdown will achieve. And there is a misunderstanding about what a shutdown will not achieve.
Abbott says there are also financial and mental health consequences associated with lockdowns. But Luis Figueroa with Every Texan says there's a cost associated with state and local officials going back and forth on this stuff. He says efforts to shut down El Paso are a good example.
We saw that in the Rio Grande Valley earlier in the year, where the hospitals became completely overrun and the state wasn't taking enough action to address the situation. So many lives could be saved if we'd work with our local communities instead of trying to fight them over power and authority.
Figueroa says a lot of what's to come depends on how the branches of our government react. So far, though, there continues to be tension. Recently, Governor Abbott accused local officials of not enforcing the restrictions they already have available to them, like limiting capacity in bars and restaurants.
Some local officials are not using the tools that are available to them to make sure that they are taking every step they need.
So if they're not using the power they already have, Abbott said local officials don't need the power to do more. But Figueroa says this is not how things should be handled moving forward, especially as cases continue to rise.
That's not working together. That's pointing fingers. And that's what we need less of.
And despite how state and local officials behave, public health experts emphasize what comes next also depends on how individuals behave. That is, whether people socially distance and wear masks in the coming weeks. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Governor Greg Abbott says Texas will get 1.4 million doses of coronavirus vaccine later this month, with more to follow. KUT's Jerry Quijano reports on who might get vaccinated first in Austin.
The city's interim health authority, Dr. Mark Escott, says local and national data show that one group is at the highest risk of contracting COVID-19, people in nursing homes.
You know, I believe that we really need to focus our efforts early on to those residents and those healthcare workers caring for individuals in those settings.
Cassandra De Leon works on disease prevention at Austin Public Health. She says preparations for a vaccine distribution like this one have been happening for years.
We've done exercises as recent as last month to prepare and plan for what are the logistical needs we need to put in place to roll out a vaccine.
Chief Epidemiologist Janet Pichette expects that positive COVID tests as a result of Thanksgiving gatherings will begin to show in the data by the end of this week. Jerry Quijano, KUT News.
The Austin Independent School District did not allow students to learn in person this week as part of an effort to curb the spread of COVID-19 after the Thanksgiving holiday. But as KUT's Claire McInerney reports, it means students will have to spend more time in class later this year.
The Texas Education Agency does not allow school districts to do entirely remote learning because the state agency requires an in-person option to always be available. AISD is getting around this rule and keeping its state funding by adding minutes onto school days throughout the year. So rather than adding on additional days at the end of the year, there will be few minutes added that make up for this week being remote. While school buildings are closed this week, all students are learning online. AISD is offering free COVID testing this week for students and staff who have been attending or teaching in-person classes. The hope is to make sure when schools open again next week, there aren't COVID outbreaks throughout the district. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
One unexpected challenge of the coronavirus pandemic for schools, a shortage of substitute teachers. KUT's Rianne Roldan reports on what that's like in Hayes CISD.
During a typical year, Hayes CISD has about 600 substitutes in their system that are active and available. This year, they only have 200. And because of the pandemic, they've also had an increase in the need for substitutes, especially with teachers having to quarantine because of testing positive from COVID-19 or even from exposure to it. District spokesman Tim Savoy says they're having to use other staff on campus and even the district's central office to cover teacher absences. But he's also got an idea for a solution. Gig economy workers, especially those in the film or music industries.
If they're looking for work and they haven't thought about it, being a substitute teacher might be just the right fit for the time being. And it would help schools and students out, and it would help them out if they had a source of income. It's definitely something that might be a win-win if you can take two problems and maybe help them solve each other.
Savoy says anyone interested in becoming a substitute teacher can check out the application on the district's website. Rianne Roldan, KUT News.
If you live in Northwest Austin starting today, there's another election to vote on. City Council Districts 6 and 10 need a runoff to decide a winner. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey and KUT's Andrew Weber break down the races, starting with Audrey in District 6.
Councilmember Jimmy Flanagan currently represents this area, what I'll call far Northwest Austin. If you live here, you'll have to choose from the incumbent, Flanagan, or his challenger, Mackenzie Kelly. The two diverge on a lot of issues, which we'll get to. But both Kelly and Flanagan market themselves as fiscally responsible, at times conservative when it comes to city spending. Here's Flanagan at a League of Women Voters forum this week.
I have been described by the Statesman in their endorsement of my campaign as the fiscal conscience of the dais. And I have taken more hard votes against spending and have even voted against city budgets when I didn't feel that it met the test of fiscal responsibility.
And here's Kelly at the same forum proposing one way to control spending.
One of my solutions that I would like to see come forward when elected
is to do an external audit of the city and find out where we have wasteful spending.
Now, to those differences I mentioned. Last year, council members voted to largely legalize camping, sitting, and panhandling in public. In other words, they undid most of the laws that allowed police to ticket people living on the streets. Flanagan, as you can probably guess, does not want to reinstate that ban.
Simply banning camping does not solve homelessness. All it does is move these humans, these neighbors, back into the shadows where we saw increased levels of crime against these folks when they've committed no other crime.
But Kelly has said the council's decision to repeal the ban against camping, quote, encouraged and enabled a homelessness crisis. She wants to reinstate it. As for how else to solve homelessness,
we need to give them a specific location to go to where they can have their needs addressed, and we can work to lift them up out of that situation.
Kelly also disagrees with the council's decision this summer to reduce the Austin police budget by $150 million, even though most of that money is just departments being moved out from under police. The council also paused new cadet classes, which Kelly says makes her worry about staffing.
We need to refund the police department and ensure that we have the proper amount of staffing for our community so that our community is not experiencing longer wait times for services.
At the same time, she says police should not have to respond to so many types of calls, which Flanagan argues is exactly one of the intentions behind cutting some of the police department's budget.
Meaningful changes to the department so that police aren't responding to everything is precisely what we're doing. We are precisely trying to get our police officers into a place where they are responding specifically to the tasks and jobs for which they are specially trained and best suited.
You'll find a similar disagreement over how the city should or should not fund police in the District 10 race. For specifics on that runoff election, I'll hand you over to my colleague, Andrew Weber.
Thanks, Audrey. The District 10 police funding fight is similar to the one in D6. There's an incumbent facing a challenger who's running against that decision to cut the police budget. In District 10, Jennifer Verdon is that challenger. She wants to roll back those cuts and doesn't believe there's systemic racism in the department. She also disagrees with the decision to suspend the department's cadet classes for the next year and a half. She says that could put the department behind the eight ball in terms of retention and attraction of new officers.
That is not something that I would have ever been in favor of on the dais. I think it's one of the most dangerous things we've ever done for the city of Austin.
Alter says a change in training is needed, and that when cadet classes begin again, they'll have courses on the history of policing and how police are viewed in the community at large.
One of the things that a police officer needs to be able to do is they need to be able to address various communities across the city and understand their own cultures and where they're coming from and how they communicate to keep everyone safe.
Homelessness was also a big campaign issue in the district, even though it has one of the lowest homeless populations in the city. Verdon wants to reinstate the city's ban on camping, and she wants to lean on shelter programs like the Community First Village, run by the nonprofit Mobile Loaves and Fishes, to house people living outside. Alter says the city's current plan to retrofit hotels to serve as transitional housing is the right way to address an increase of camps. It's quicker and more centrally located.
The models that we have with the hotels that we have adopted, that we are moving forward with, are ones that get set up and run much more quickly. It is much easier to take an existing building and convert it than it is to create new organizations.
Then there's the recently passed Prop A, the plan to build out light rail in Austin and bolster the city's rapid bus system. Voters in District 10 largely voted against it. Verdon argues that while homeowners in the district will pay the tax increase to fund the expansion, the district won't see much benefit. It's slated to get an expanded bus service and a couple of park and rides.
In District 10, we would absolutely have no way to board that train or any of the project, but we bear the most financial expense for it. So I just want to make sure that District 10 hears me say that I am... definitely will take that into consideration when I'm voting on the dais.
But Alter says things like Prop A are part of the job, that obviously the District 10 seat on the dais represents District 10, but there's still a larger collective responsibility to the entire city, whether it's transportation or homelessness or policing.
You don't just represent your own district. And one of the things I've really enjoyed about being a council member is learning about the opportunities and challenges in different parts of the city. All of these things combine to make up the fabric of our city. And District 10 has a responsibility to lead.
Early voting for these two runoffs starts December 3rd and runs through the 11th. Election day is December 15th. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Thank you.
Voting is underway in a runoff election for the Georgetown City Council. KUT's Allison Ortegon reports on the race between Lisa King and Sean Hood.
The two candidates are both local business owners in Georgetown, with their offices occupying space in the city's main square. And both are leaning on their local knowledge as they compete for the District 2 seat, especially to address a hot-button issue for fast-growing Williamson County, development. Candidate Lisa King says she wants to see, quote, respectful development, maintaining the existing parts of the city while still allowing for growth.
There's not much to correct. It's just to make sure that we're not getting away from all the things that our current residents and the people who are moving here desire about our community.
And her opponent, Sean Hood, has a similar vision in mind, but he feels his work in his architectural design practice has uniquely prepared him to listen to the community and relay their needs to council while combating partisanship.
Should I have the fortune of being elected city council person for Georgetown, I want to represent everyone equitably.
Early voting continues through Friday, December 11th. Election day is December 15th. Alice Ortegon, KUT News.
A showcase of films by or about Black people kicks off today in Austin. KUT's Sangeeta Menon reports on the Capital City Black Film Festival.
The festival will be completely virtual this year because of the pandemic. About 60 films, including five by Austin filmmakers, address the pandemic, police brutality, and the central theme of this year's event, mental health. Founder and executive director of the festival, Winston Williams, says the theme was selected last year based on his own experience with a counselor.
The amount of things that he has unlocked in me in order for me to truly experience the success, I felt like that message needed to be shared, that encouragement. There is no stigma behind getting help for mental health issues.
Panels will discuss mental health issues specific to those working in the film industry as part of the festival. The event runs from Friday through Sunday. Sangeeta Menon, KUT News.
Even with promising developments on the vaccine front, scientists around the globe are still racing to find other vaccines and potential treatments for COVID-19. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, there's a growing group of unwitting and unsung heroes in this pursuit, the lab mice.
Every good story needs a hero, a completely silent hero.
You've worked with mice for how long?
7 years.
And what sounds do they make?
No sounds. They just crawl. The only thing you can hear is them creepily crawling on their bed, little like things that they have in their cage. So,
this is Niarika Reddybody, a cancer research associate at UT's Dell Medical School. She says they may be quiet, but they don't exactly keep their mouths shut.
They bite you like crazy. I had times where I had like band-aids on all my fingers. So that's one little thing. So yeah.
Body is working with a mouse colony for COVID-19 vaccine research. She is working with UT biologist and cancer researcher John Powers on a potential solution. Until the spring, John's lab and everyone in it were working on potential cures for melanoma and pancreatic cancer. But, like much of the world, his lab's focus changed. And for COVID research, he needed a very specific COVID mouse.
So this mouse was actually designed about 10 years ago when SARS-1 hit, because SARS-1 also targets the human ACE2 receptor. So they engineered these mice to express that receptor. So they express human ACE2 in a lot of the same places we do, in the lungs and the epithelial tissues. And they've brought the mouse back because of SARS-CoV-2.
And this mouse model, as it's referred to in the scientific community, is critical to the research. Its response to the coronavirus is similar to humans, thanks to its engineered trait.
SARS-CoV-2 happens to recognize and bind to the ACE2 receptor, which is involved in blood pressure, and it's actually widely expressed in the human body.
Full disclosure here, John and I have known each other since high school. We even took the same science classes. He paid better attention. Back to the mice. They have become instrumental, not just in John's lab, but around the world in the race to find a vaccine or treatment for SARS-CoV-2.
They're small, they breed quickly, they're relatively inexpensive, and they're not a perfect match for us, but they're better than, say a salamander.
And more than likely, they all came from the same place, the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine. Jackson Lab supplies more than 11,000 mouse models that express certain genes of interest. Kat Lutz is senior director there. She says it normally takes years to build demand for a type of mouse for research, But thanks to the SARS mouse and its cryogenically frozen sperm and eggs, they cut to the chase.
Instead of just importing a few mice and breeding them in that Noah's Ark 2x2 method, we did these massive in vitro fertilizations in order to go from just a few vials of sperm to colony sizes that were in the thousands.
And these mice, these unwitting heroes of COVID-19 research, help researchers understand what happens to patients suffering from the worst aspects of the disease.
They get acute respiratory syndrome, just like the patients do. And they also can have a cytokine release storm, which is what we see in some of the most illest of patients.
And like the most ill patients, some of the mice will not make it. But all the mice provide useful data for labs across the world, from Paris to Austin. In recent weeks, a handful of companies have announced positive results on COVID-19 vaccines. And while John Power's lab has not produced one yet, the work continues because you just never know when it could be needed.
So there is a chance that we'll have a vaccine soon, and that would be outstanding. But the way we're kind of envisioning our contribution is kind of a second line. If for whatever reasons those vaccines aren't great or they don't work, that would be, you know, not the outcome we want. But then maybe groups like us are kind of bringing up a second round of shots on goal.
And when a viable vaccine is available, later this month, in 2021, or whenever, spare a thought for the thousands of mice who helped researchers better understand the ravages of COVID-19. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the first weekend of December 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.